Radio crew, let's get to work. Hope everybody's well. Hope everybody's having a good week. This week's guest is Mr. Luke Philpott. Luke is a former military police operative with over 10 years of experience. His primary function working within the military police include delivering law enforcement, discipline, mission support, and a variety of investigative roles. Expect to learn what the military police do and how they are different from those in the civilian world, the powers of military police personnel and their limitations, the role of confidence, charisma, and calm tonality in diffusing tense situations, the largest mistakes most people make when starting out in a military role with a chain of command, the pathways available for entry into the military police, and all things policing within the Army framework. Crew, I've always had a little bit of a fascination with the mystery doors of the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force. So for me, this episode was really nice to be able to drill down into Luke's past working within the military establishment, actually getting that first-hand knowledge of somebody who's been there and done that. Interesting that when you try and get information about these things, usually it's done in the case of an expo or a show day. They throw you a pamphlet, they show you a fancy advertisement that they have on a screen, and that's kind of it. You might get a brief testimonial, but this was a really nice account of just what somebody working within the military police actually does in the Army. Guys, I hope you enjoy this episode as much as I did. For now, though, please welcome Mr. Luke Philpott. Mr. Luke Philpott, welcome to the show. How are you, my friend?
Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it. I'm good, thanks.
You're welcome. Mate, I've been looking forward to this ever since I reached out to you a few weeks ago, and I've been thinking a lot about you in general and what an interesting career you've had. Mate, can you tell us a little bit about your career pathway? Quite an interesting one. You started out in the Army and kind of moved in a range of different directions. Take us from the start.
Yeah, well, I did have a pretty varied defense career, to be honest. I started off in infantry and did that for a year, then transferred to the reserves because I wanted to do some university stuff. And while I was in the reserve, I transferred to military police. And then I got back in full time. So I was probably only a reservist for probably 3 years. And then I was full time from 2011 through to the end of 2019 as an MP. I started off in our military police battalion, which handles like not really policing stuff, but more like battlefield policing roles, like peacekeeping stuff, detainee operations, all that sort of stuff that would happen in a conflict. And then I specialized straight into investigations and forensics. And I started that pathway in, I don't know, 2014, 2015, I think. Yeah, probably, maybe even 2013. Yeah.
Mate, so, you know, is there any shortcuts to getting to MP? And just for the people that are unsure of what an MP is, and correct me if I'm wrong, MP is military police, right? Am I accurate?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Okay. So policing in the military, is there any shortcuts to kind of get into that role? Like, I guess in the civilian world, you roll into a police academy, you do like a course, they, I guess, show you how to point and shoot a handgun and a variety of other tasty theoretical laws that you may need to know. Is there something similar that you had to go through? Like you mentioned you were in reserves, but like, can I just roll into the barracks and go, hey, I want to join the MPs. Like, what do I need to do?
Yeah. So it's one of the career pathways that's available for direct entry. So basically what would happen is you'd pass various tiers or levels to where you can go into your career. So for example, you would start off with your basic, you'd go through the recruitment process. And if you're accepted, you go through to basic training. And then after basic training, you do your initial employment training. And so for military police, that initial employment training is at Holsworthy Barracks in Sydney. You do that. And then while you're there, you usually find out where you're likely to be posted and into what role. The two roles that people can be posted into is either what we call Joint Military Police Unit, which is the domestic policing side of things. And the other thing, which is most common, I think, for people who are new and starting out, is they go to battalion first. But that can differ depending on organizational needs. So that's not definitive. Yeah.
Gotcha. So you mentioned just some of the roles in my first question. You were sort of talking a little bit about some of the things that you did within the role of, as an MP. I feel like there's this stereotype around MPs that, you know, you guys deal with intense situations day to day, you know, that there's like underground military operation that you guys are kind of facilitating or kind of monitoring or somehow getting involved with. That's just kind of like the perception I get. But I know very few people in that role. I feel like it's quite a niche role. How wrong or right is that misconception in your view?
I think generally speaking, in day-to-day intense situations, I would say that's not the case. I would say it's something that we train and prepare for, definitely. But we also, like, it's a policing function, but it's also a command function as well in the domestic policing aspect of it. If you're in battalion, you're a bit more, there's more of a focus on being battle ready, I guess. So that comes with more intense physical training probably than the domestic policing side of things. I mean, I've been in some tense situations and there's a lot of steps you can take to sort of minimize the chance that things will get sort of out of hand. But I do know some military police that have been in some really, really full-on situations as well. Most of the full-on situations that we'd be exposed to is incident response, to be honest, where in the form of a vehicle accident or something like that, where things are pretty intense. But in terms of physical confrontations, like really big ones, they're not that common. They'd be more common in the state policing world, I would say.
What is the most intense situation that you experience in your entire career as an MP?
There's been plenty of risky ones. I mean, I'm limited in terms of to like what details I could go into, obviously, but
of course,
I've interviewed because I sort of specialized quite quickly into the investigative side of things, where I was investigating like more complex crime and more like major things rather than just minor misdemeanors, I guess, if you will. Generally, if we were talking to people, they're potentially in very, very big trouble and they want to try and minimize the damage to their career. So under most circumstances, they're not going to do anything that could jeopardize their career. The times to look out for that is when they feel like they've got nothing to lose. They might be alcohol affected or drug affected potentially. The most intense situation I've been in was probably I went to interview someone and we advised him at the start not to bring his wife along due to the kind of allegations that we were going to be inquiring about. And he opted to bring her along to hear the allegation, which was really not a smart move on his part given the nature of it. And then when we put the allegation to him, he got very annoyed and very frustrated and he didn't have as much self-control as some others. You know, but nothing eventuated from it, but it was very much a tense situation, you know. But we gave him the warnings and we're trying to look after him in that regard. And it ended up having probably pretty decent personal ramifications for him.
It's interesting, isn't it, that sometimes, so there's this saying that I've used in the past across different industries in that honey sometimes wins the birds. And in short, what it's, I guess the message that it's trying to convey is that sometimes when there's aggression or a tense situation, sometimes, you know, rather than sort of meeting that with more aggression, sometimes going the other way and meeting it with, you know, gentleness and kindness seems to be able to diffuse that situation. So an example would be as a teacher, you know, you might see two students or maybe one student in a class becoming very physically confrontational. And some of the methods, rather than sort of, you know, raising your voice and getting angry at that student, you know, just literally staying super calm and just going, well, you know, why don't you tell me a little bit about it? What's going on? You know, like I'm a little bit confused. I haven't seen this side of you before. Yeah. I'm just like, you know, what's happening? And I think the magic words for me in these sort of conflicting, and as you know, I used to work security and bodyguarding for a while. And I guess the same thing applied there where, you know, if you turned around and said, you know, tell me how you're feeling, what's going on? And just literally getting them to open up and talk to you is like more of a diffuser than, you know, I guess meeting it with aggression. Of course, there's a time and a place for physical intervention. But more often than not, I don't know if it's the same in your industry, but more often than not, words can win most situations.
Yeah, I think so. And most of the time when we were talking to people, I find it's the unknown often. In terms of if you're dealing with someone who's potentially like under the influence of alcohol or drugs, it's kind of different. But in terms of people who who aren't affected by that. Most of the time, people are aggressive or likely to act that way if they're just not well informed, to be honest. So it's, yeah, I've always made it a priority to make sure people understand their rights and understand that we're just trying to find out information. We're not there to stitch anyone up. Like that's, there's, I've never seen, you know, I've never seen that happen or anything like that. And it's very much, yeah, people just want to know, what's this information going to be used for that I'm providing you? Do I have to talk to you? All those different things. Like, you know, you're saying that I don't have to talk to you legally, but like if I don't, will my chain of command get angry with me? Or if we're talking to a witness, because most of the time we're talking to witnesses, not people who are actually doing the crimes. A lot of the time they're like, oh, can he hurt me if I say this? Like, what? How can you protect me out of this kind of thing? So, I mean, that's kind of like a shotgun answer to your question, but generally informing people is, and knowing your job and knowing it well, is probably one of the best ways to sort of mitigate most of those sort of situations.
And I mean, that's coming from, you know, experience and, you know, doing the job day in, day out. You're going to pick up the social cues that you need to learn pretty quickly in order to become effective, right? I'm just thinking though, early on for people moving into that space of being an MP. So, you know, when they first start the gig and obviously yourself, when you first moved into that space as well, do you see like a common mistake that people make in that job? Is there something that, you know, you can kind of pick really early on that most people are doing that they need guidance around?
Yeah, I'd say the biggest thing is try not to get thrown into a situation where you don't have someone else with you or someone more experienced with you, because generally if you're working in pairs, and you should be, the person who's more experienced will do the majority of the talking because they sort of understand how to de-escalate those situations. But most of the mistakes, generally speaking, that I see people do is they think that a rule or a practice in terms of the way we operate always applies perfectly within the situation, and they don't think dynamically and go, oh, in this situation it's kind of slightly different, so maybe if I sort of slightly change the way I do things or the way that I talk about this, it could de-escalate the situation. Whereas if they just stick to a very rigid conversational approach, it might not really work that well in all situations, if that makes sense.
100%. I was just having this exact same conversation with a previous guest, and it was around this idea of like sticking to the book too hard, and how if you do that, you know, you can get quite far. You know, you can become quite respectable by sticking to the rule book or the guidebook. And, you know, we all know those people that pick up the, you know, what do you call it, the staff document, and, you know, memorize the acts and the laws, yeah, word for word, and that, you know, we know them as the common bush lawyer, right? And quite often these people are disliked very quickly as well, which really doesn't help them in terms of conflict de-escalation.
Yeah.
But I think that what we were talking about came back to a conversation that I'd heard through another podcast, actually, where it was, I think it was Jocko Willink, I think that's his name, you know, ex-Navy SEAL guy. He's all about taking ownership of a situation. And one of the things that he was talking about was that those that stick to, you know, those scripts and rules, you know, that, yeah, they can get pretty far, but nowhere near as far, and they're nowhere near as effective as somebody that can, as you say, think dynamically in the situation. So use the basis. Use the foundation of what the script might sort of lean towards, but then think for yourself and go, well, actually, how can I not manipulate it, but how can I kind of bend this to the situation that we've got right in front of us? Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that resonates with me. I think ultimately in military policing, to apply that well, you need to understand what is a legal requirement and what is just a general policy or a guideline. And if in doubt, stick to the guideline. But once you know what's a guideline and what's a law, you know you've got a much better gauge of what you can do and different approaches to various situations. It's very much a career where the smarter you are, the further you go, really, in the investigation space. So it rewards intellect and smart thinking for sure.
Yeah. So, you know, in terms of, is there much capacity for scalability and career progression as an MP? Like when you get there, is that it? Or is there kind of like in the civilian world, you've kind of got rankings of police officers, you know, sergeant and so on. Do you guys have something similar in terms of rankings as a MP?
Yeah, we do. Absolutely. So it follows a standard sort of rank progression. So I can only speak to the other ranks area of that, which starts off as at a private level and goes all the way through to warrant officer class 1. So you can go all the way up through that rank that rank structure. And the more, generally speaking, the more diverse your military policing career is, the further you're able to go, because obviously they don't want someone in upper management who hasn't got a couple of different specializations, but also been a battalion MP, but also domestically an MP with Joint Military Police Unit as well. Going into your career with an open mindset to make sure that you take the opportunities that come your way rather than thinking, I only want to do this area of policing, will really help you long-term in your career.
Is it kind of like as you move through the ranks, do you continue to do the same content in terms of your day-to-day tasks, or do you move away to become sort of less on the field and more sort of paper-based, you know, reporter style? The reason I ask that question is it seems like almost in across many careers, do you know what I mean? It's kind of like almost, and I don't want to generalize too much, but almost the more important roles. So, you know, the person driving the digger in excavation is like the most important person to getting the job actually done. But then you've got like, you know, the supervisor that's kind of rolling around with an iPad telling him to dig here, 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 and here. It's a strange thing that it's just the nature and the hierarchy of careers. Is it kind of similar in MP as well, where as time goes on, you sort of start moving away from the groundwork, so to speak?
Yeah, that is the case. I think if you're in the domestic policing space in Joint Military Police Unit, I think generally once you go above the rank of sergeant, so one officer class two, you're pretty much in a solely in a management role then, and you wouldn't spend much time sort of on the ground doing the job. I mean, you'd still be reviewing documentation and stuff and using your expertise to go, this is a line of inquiry you haven't considered. You should have a look at that. So in that space, in the domestic sense, after the rank of sergeant, sergeant's pretty much where that on the ground work kind of starts to end. In the battalion field military policing space, it's higher than that, I'd say. That sort of really cuts in at sort of one officer class one. So you've got one officer class two is kind of the last big field related rank where you'd be sort of on the ground doing the job, so to speak. But the management roles are quite diverse as well. So a lot of the times in, I think most careers, if you're sort of in upper management, I think it's a much more narrow pathway than in the military. Whereas like in the military, kind of as you go up the ranks, there's actually kind of more opportunities to branch out and to go into various different areas, because as you go up the rank level, your organizational experience increases, and then that means you can do what's called like out of corps postings as well. You can still do that in lower ranks, but generally there's more available, I think, in the higher ranks.
If you're going for a high rank, do you guys have to do interviews like the civilian world as well? Like, are you interviewed by a panel of people to step up into that new role, so to speak?
Not really. It's mostly on initial entry, and when you specialize into investigations, there's like sort of like a job ready process you go through. But after that, it's all based on your performance and what your reporting looks like in terms of your career pathway. And that's determined by boards and things like that. So it's a pretty good and fair process, to be honest. But there's not many roles that you'd be interviewed for. I think if you go into Defence Force recruiting, you'd be interviewed. And some of the higher officer level ranks, I think they'd have panels and stuff like that. But generally speaking, there's not interviews that you would go through to progress.
So, you know, we've kind of touched on the idea that, you know, some people working as MP, they really stick to the book and don't think flexibly in a situation. Is there any other mistakes that you have witnessed and seen throughout your career working as an MP, either in your own battalion or across friendship groups in the military?
Yeah, I think something that really helped me is you need to really carry a professional tone and appearance, and you really need to know what you're talking about. And you pretty much can never look not confident. You've always got to be confident in what you're doing, because people are relying pretty heavily on you. We have unit command structures which are very reliant on us to be able to make informed decisions. We have witnesses that are in a really vulnerable and victims that are in a really vulnerable position. They also need to feel like you know what you're doing as well. And that's where you start to get them to open up a bit more. And also, like, people who are being investigated, they need to know that, you know, what their rights are, what their obligations are, and just they'll be able to trust what you're saying if you have, you know, a certain demeanor, if that makes sense.
How can somebody improve their confidence?
Most of confidence is knowing what you're doing, I think, to be honest, in my space. And that's probably the biggest thing. I mean, there's like charisma comes into it as well. Appearance comes into it. So it differs, but we had a bit of flexibility in terms of what we wore. We didn't always wear uniform. We used business attire sometimes. And also that's more appropriate sometimes as well. And if you're the only person in a suit walking to a unit full of people in uniform, an assumption that you're there for something important, and that helps, because like that's what you are there for, something important. So it kind of just helps you and sort of sets you apart, but in a positive, good way for what you're trying to achieve. Yeah.
Charisma is a super interesting topic to me. I was just listening to, it sounds like I'm always listening to a podcast, but I try and learn as much as I can about as many topics as I can. And one of the most recent episodes I was listening to by, I think it was The Art of Manliness. Great podcast. Check it out if you're not listening to it. They were talking about the two factors. So I think one of the studies they looked at, there were really two questions that they asked a bunch of people. One of the questions was, who is the most charismatic person that you know? And very quickly, within, I think it was 2 to 3 seconds, people were able to respond to that question very, very quickly. They knew who their most charismatic person was in their mind, right? The second question, which took them much longer, in fact, it was sort of five times as long, so sort of around that 15-second mark, was around what factors, what things make that person the most charismatic person. And so it was very easy to identify who was charismatic, but very hard to pinpoint what it was about them that made them charismatic. Right. And anyway, across this study, it narrowed the factors right down to two things. And they were competence, so high levels of competence. And mm-hmm. the second one was like a degree of gentleness or approachability. And what was happening with these studies was that if you had really high levels of competence, but you were kind of quite cold in your demeanor, or you were, you know, so logical that you maybe, you know, didn't have perhaps as high a level of emotional intelligence, people kind of switched off and you kind of become not very likable, because you're kind of coming off as, you know, highly competent, but not somebody that can listen to others and kind of take feedback and all those things, right? But then the person that's super competent on the other side of things, if they're super gentle and really approachable, they sort of come across as like not competent if they don't have any competence at all. And it's sort of like, well, they're just hopeless at everything. Like they're not really that likable because they're really not good at much at all. And you kind of end up sort of, you know, walking them along in everything that they do. So it was just interesting when you mentioned charisma that, you know, sometimes, I mean, we know that being charismatic obviously helps in so many situations, but it's kind of like, I guess, nice to know what actually makes somebody charismatic, at least according to research, right?
Yeah. I was just going to say something that's probably helped me out is when someone asks you a question, even if you know the answer, take like, especially if it's something they don't expect you to know, or they think you'll take a bit of time to answer it, take a quick pause before you answer, because they know then that you've considered what it is you're telling them, and you're more likely to be telling the right thing rather than either saying it so quickly they feel like they've been cut off and they had nothing else you wanted them to add, or they think you haven't thought it through. And that sort of leans into that. It's kind of charisma helping your appearance of competence. Yeah.
It was really interesting. They were talking about things that you could do to actually make you more charismatic in the episode I was talking about before. And one of them was, it was kind of really interesting. It was about leaning in when you had something either really good to say, or if you felt that somebody else had something really good to say. So if right now you started talking about the most amazing chocolates and I started, you know, coming towards the camera like this, then apparently the human brain actually is like cued to recognize that as like something good is about to happen, or, you know, they're acknowledging that this is something really good. And it comes from things like, you know, if you're going to go and smell something, you know, you expect, if you're going to go and smell how nice those chocolate muffins are coming out of the oven, you actually lean into that chocolate muffin, don't you? You kind of lean towards, or you might pick it up and then you'll kind of lean towards it even then, right? It's just a really strange behaviors that we all have that I guess can be, when thought about, used to our advantage. In terms of your own personal challenges, mistakes in your own practice, you've mentioned a bunch of mistakes and things that you've observed across the industry in your time. What are some of the biggest mistakes you've made working as an MP?
Probably mine is it took me a while to develop a strategic awareness. So knowing where you fit within the wider organization is I think really helpful, because you start to look at your job through the right lens rather than having your own personal priorities and aspirations driving what you do. You have more of an organizational focus on what it is that you need to do for the benefit of the organization within your role. And that kind of in the military policing context, I think that's particularly important.
100%. So how did you overcome that mistake? I mean, you talked about gaining, you know, awareness of the greater machine, so to speak. Did that involve you sort of seeking out insights across the different areas of military police, or did it come about more naturally where you just started interacting with different roles within the MP career?
I think just the longer you're in an organization, the more awareness you have. And I think that really speaks to the importance. I mean, there's a lot going around at the moment of just change careers so you can get that pay rise, you know, and you'll get the pay rise and you'll be in that other organization. But if you want to be really effective in your role, particularly something that was as intricate as the one that I was in and had so many complicated influencing factors, like it's in a way more complicated than a state policing or federal policing context, I think, the dynamics. And so having that wider strategic knowledge really helps you. And in terms of how I developed it, just over time, it's just one of those things you learn over time.
It's interesting as well when you roll into an organization, it's you kind of get a sense really quickly of like who's in charge, who to go to for what situation. But then there's always those people that really surprise you. You know, you can be kind of, I don't know, for me, sometimes 1, maybe 2 years, and it could just be that I've got poor social cues or something like that, but or that I'm not recognizing cues as well as I should be. But sometimes I'm really surprised in that, you know, a year down the line, if I've moved into a new role, it's like, wow, I didn't realize that you were that person, or that you were a part of this organization, or that, you know, you did this within the company. It's kind of, I feel like there needs to be some deliberate getting to know people, whether it be attending those Christmas functions. And I have no idea if you guys do Christmas functions at the end of the year. If you do, I definitely want an invite. Yes, please. But I just think, like, you know, there has to be some deliberate action, right? There has to be some, let's get to know the people around me. And some people are great at that. They're naturally like a social butterfly. You see them kind of moving around almost office to office, getting to know people within an organization. But then other people, and I was like this early on, like maybe 8 or 9 years ago in different roles, I was kind of the guy that like sat in his office and just like, you know, super highly competent, or at least I think that I was at the time, but I really didn't want to talk to anybody. I was kind of antisocial, and I kind of just like stayed in my office and just waited for people to come to me. But I learned pretty quickly that there are a lot of perks to getting out there and talking to the people that are in your organization. And more than that, when you actually go for a promotion, people actually know who you are. They get a sense of your character more than just, oh yeah, he's the guy in office 101. You know, they actually go, oh yeah, that's Tim. He's you know, really great at X, Y, and Z, and you know, they just know a little bit more about you. What is your single biggest piece of advice to guys coming through the door right now?
I think if you're ever unsure of what to do, like if you can ask someone, you know, I think you're in the early days, you're better off being hesitant when you need to be, unless it's like a immediate safety problem, I guess. Yeah, sometimes calling and getting that clarification, particularly if you have to make an important decision, getting someone to tell you what they would like you to do is often the best way, because then they're accountable and you're not, because they were the decision maker. Those sort of things would happen reasonably often, where I would call my boss and say, hey, look, I need some top cover for this. These are the two situations. These are the two different ways I could handle this. What do you recommend? What are you comfortable with? Here are the pros and cons. And they usually just tell me one way or the other, and off we go.
I'm interested in the jurisdiction differences between civilian police, you know, the average cop that you see rolling down the street, and somebody like military police. Like, can you roll down the street and arrest somebody? Is that something you guys are able to do outside of the army context, or is it kind of like restricted to an army barracks, or is there like certain land? How does it kind of all work?
That's a big question. Generally, what I would say, I guess there's two parts to this question. I think one, the first part is that we sit within an organization and we're a policing element for that organization. So, and with that, I was training some police officers who were doing a bridging course into becoming reserve military police. And one thing I told them is that you have, as a police officer, quite definitive powers and laws and things you can do legally. And it's quite broad and very definitive. But often they don't have, in some cases, they might not have too much intrinsic power. So, for example, if a police officer sees someone taking a pill of, I don't know, a drug that they're not supposed to have, they can fine them, issue them like a, they can issue them a fine or maybe even give them a court date for possession kind of thing. But the fallout of that is much lower than if someone did it in defense, for example, because their entire career is on the line then. So they kind of have lots of law backing them. And we do too, and it's getting better. Like they've updated the legislation, which is good. But when it's an entire career and you're the person investigating it, you kind of have a bit more power, sometimes more power than I was comfortable with. But the decision makers, like we're not really decision makers, we're just investigators. In saying that, someone's chain of command and their bosses rely heavily on the information that we provide them as well. So we're very open and transparent and are very careful to make sure we list all the relevant information. But the fallout of that is often quite severe for the person if it's quite a serious thing. In terms of the jurisdictional environment specifically, our powers extend beyond a military establishment, but only to people who are actually actively in service, military people. So we couldn't arrest a civilian outside of a military establishment. We could detain them if it was to protect equipment or assets under certain circumstances. Yeah, so under certain circumstances, we could detain people who aren't in the military if it was to protect a military asset. You know, it's sort of common sense stuff, really. Mm. I have investigated people that were outside of defense before and not a military person as a result of inquiries that came across our desk that related to a state police matter, for example. So we exchange information where it's relevant. They provide us with information. We provide them with information just to help everyone out, I guess.
Awesome, mate. Thanks for satisfying my curiosity. Mate, you've sort of hung up the cape for the meantime. You've sort of moved into a very, very different space and your life looks quite different. Now, do you miss it?
I mean, I still do it occasionally as a reservist now. End of 2019, I became a reservist again to go and do Bible college and pursue ministry. But that was like a calling I had, which led to that decision. It wasn't because I didn't like the career that I was in. I was in a great career earning really good money. But doing what I do now is what I love and what I feel like I'm called to do. And it was the best decision ever. But I wouldn't say that decision is based off this, what I'm doing now, being materially better than what I was doing then, if that makes sense. So it wasn't out of a dissatisfaction from my previous career at all.
Mate, it takes a lot of guts and a lot of will to just change direction in your life. And I've done it on a few occasions, and every time I've done it, it's just so refreshing. It's like, and for want of a better analogy, you know, I don't drink anymore, but back in the day, if you just drank, you know, a bunch of beers and somebody handed you, I don't know, some kind of spirit, it was like, you know, oh, great, something different. But it was just refreshing. It's just refreshing to change direction. Mate, if people want to get in touch, if people want to ask you some questions about your time in the military, I know you'd be restricted under in terms of what you can say against certain topics, but if people want to get in touch, where can they go? How can they get in touch?
Yeah, so they can just get in touch with me on Instagram. I don't post a lot of stuff on there, but I can message them on there. That's no problem. It's Luke Philpott 89.
Love it, mate. Thanks again for your time, Luke. Really appreciate it.
No problem. Anytime.
Well, there you go, crew. Another look into a profession that is probably not particularly well known for us mere civilians. For those thinking of changing careers and signing up to the military, the first point of call is the aptitude test. That can be booked in just about any army barracks around Australia, to my understanding. Having done the aptitude test myself, I'd highly recommend you study your maths and pattern recognition. Crew, if you enjoyed this episode or any of the other episodes, please be sure to subscribe or follow on your favorite platform so you can get a fancy notification pop up on your phone when the latest episode drops weekly. Also, crew, check out at Mistake Mastery on Instagram, where we post mistakes learned from our guests and the best workaround for them so that you don't have to make them when you next interact as or with those professions moving forward. Until next time, crew, take care.